episode 11 of the Net Wildland podcast with me, Penny Green, and today I'm out and about with Matthew Oates, and we are having an adventure today exploring some other parts of NEP, including the regenerative farm project, but also we've just dipped across into the northern block of the rewilding project, and we're currently sitting by a lovely stream surrounded by primroses and cuckoo flower, wood anemone. What else can we see? Oh, celandines
and bluebells on our left.
It's a gorgeous time, isn't it, Matthew? We love this time of year.
It's my favourite time of year, and my favourite colour, all-time favourite colour, is that yellow-green of oak leaflets, particularly when juxtaposed against this azure blue, which we've got today. We're actually in paradise.
It's glorious, isn't it? We're sitting by this lovely stream, and we've been watching one of the harbingers of spring, the orange tip. And that's today's podcast is going to be all about the orange tip.
Yep, the orange tip butterfly. Now, it's one of the eight species of British butterfly I would take with me to a desert island in lieu of gramophone records.
Wow. Okay. Why is that, Matthew?
Right, because I think it refreshes the parts which other butterflies don't quite get to, with the exclusion of the purple emperor. So much of the best of British wildlife, you look at an orange tip, that pure white with that wonderful flame orange flash and the forewing, the male this is, and you think, that doesn't look British. It looks as if it belongs in another country, it's a creature of a sunnier land. And so much of our British wildlife, the best of our British wildlife, actually makes you think it's too good to be British. It belongs in somewhere sunnier, and in consequence, it actually transports you there. So there's something Mediterranean.
It's very lovely, isn't
almost
it?
Almost African about the kind of orange tip.
It has been a very long winter, hasn't it? So to be able to see these spring species, especially this year, is so kind of makes your heart sing, doesn't it?
They mean it. so much to us. They are so deeply iconic. And yes, one's first orange tip of the year. It really does mean an incredible amount. For years, I used to go out ardently and fervently in search of my first orange tip, and I walked miles and miles and knackered myself in the process. And sometimes it worked, and I've managed to see an orange tip in March. Nowadays, I let them come to me.
Well, that's a nice way of doing it, I think.
Which is normal and natural and what other people do.
you're not other people, Matthew, we know that. And sort of looking back through the Sussex Butterfly Atlas, I was reading it yesterday in preparation for our chat today, and I see that over the years, over the last maybe 25 years or so, the orange tip has started emerging perhaps a couple of weeks earlier than previously.
Yep, it's one of several of our resident butterflies which now appears earlier. I saw my first March orange tip in 1989, and I wrote in my diary, I will probably never see another March orange tip in my life. Well, that was wrong, because I've actually seen the most years in March since then. And yet, when I started butterflying in the early 1960s, here in deepest West Sussex, the orange tip would start to appear around about the 16th of April. And St George's Day, the 23rd of April, really was National Orange Tip Day. It probably still is, but in most years they are appearing towards the end of March now. So that's a jump of a couple of weeks or so, yes.
And will that give them problems long term, Matthew, when we're looking at sort of the emergence of the food plants?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because they've got to be in sync with the crucial growth phase of their food plants, plural. Because the larvae are actually seed pod feeders rather than leaf feeders. They will eat some leafage, but they prefer the more nutritious diet of the developing pods of their...
There's one flying, nice male flying around.
Lovely male.
That's gorgeous.
That purest white, that pristine snow white, and juxtaposed with that flame orange, which I don't know, it takes me to the Mediterranean or even over the other side of the Mediterranean, North Africa.
So beautiful.
That's fine. No, they're pod feeders, and the larvae, that is, and the females lay their eggs on the opening, what are those things called, sepals, of flowers of lady's smock and jack in the hedge, which is also called garlic mustard. There's various other cruciferous plants. They also breed on hedge mustards, the fear is that with climate change skewing the life cycles of so much of our things, the butterfly could come out of sync with its food plant. But that doesn't seem to be happening now. The plant is coming out earlier and the butterfly is coming out earlier. And the larvae are still able to feed on their pods.
And amazing, the larvae actually look like a seed pod, don't they? So when they're actually next to the seed pod, they're very well disguised, aren't they? Camouflaged for any sort of passing predators.
Yep, they are seriously cryptic. And they feed up relatively quickly. And then they spend the whole autumn and winter, a very long period, late summer, as pupae. They actually crawl off their food plants, which are effectively annuals. Although the dead stems of Jack in the Hedge do remain sturdy for a long time, but nearly all larvae crawl off those dead stems. Occasionally I find a pupa on a dead Jack in the Hedge stem during the winter, but it is really, really hard to find them, and it's by accident, it's by luck rather than by deliberate design. And they pupate on something sturdy, and then they spend months sitting there. It's oddly shaped.
It's quite angular, isn't it?
Yeah,
an angular
weird
pupa.
Chrysalis. It's more of a chrysalis than a pupa. I usually call these things pupas. What's beating me up there? So
a little caddisfly's landed on your hat.
A caddisfly's landed on my hat. Bless it. You're welcome here, Brother Caddis or Sister Caddis. And a lot of them do seem to get eaten during the winter, or accidentally mown or trodden on, or something ghastly happens to them. The larvae, I can tell you, because I've done some of the science on this, are eaten, devoured by tits, blue tits, great tits in particular. And I learnt this in my own garden, which of course I have a tit boxes up, and have a whole scatter of Jack in the Hedge plants in particular, some lady's smock. Which get plastered with eggs, and then I was following the young larvae through, and lo and behold, tits, blue tits in particular, were coming and pinching them when they're about half grown. So I now do orange tip caterpillar rescue. When they're about a third grown, I pick the stem they're on, put it in a vase of water in our open south facing porch, and leave them to it. And they finish off feeding up in the sanctity of the porch, pupate all over the porch. I even had one on the door handle one year, which meant we had to be very careful about opening the door for several months.
You couldn't rush for the postman,
could
you?
Oh, here he comes. Lovely male orange tip. Came to see us and flew past. And then they let themselves out, just fly away, emerge and fly away the following spring. And that's me. That's the sort of thing I used to do as a child, and I find I'm an old age pensioner now. I'm still doing it.
That's the main thing.
It's good fun. It helps the orange tips, and I don't. The blue tips, I'm sorry, can just go and do something else.
Go and eat some seeds off a seed feeder.
they don't have to be. They don't have to eat my orange tips. I've done some bit more work, and I found that happens elsewhere. Monitoring larvae, and they disappear half grown. So someone's eating them.
Interesting.
It's difficult being a caterpillar. It really is.
Well, as we learnt with the purple emperors last year, like you said, the tits get them as well, don't they?
It just so happens to be tits in both occasions.
So with obviously you've just described that lovely orange flash on the orange tip male's wing, and that is a warning coloration.
Well, it's supposed to be a warning colour. It's supposed to say,
"I'm
not nice to eat," because as a caterpillar, I ingested a whole load of chemicals which are toxic to you.
And that's from the lady's smock and the garlic mustard, isn't it? Because got sort of quite sort of toxic. Chemicals to them,
aren't they? I think you will also find that the male butterflies, here he comes again, he's checking out, naughty boy, he's checking out all the lady's smock flower heads, looking for a female. If he finds a female on a lady's smock head, she will be mated, and he knows that.
So it's another male.
No,
sorry.
It's another male going. Yep. She's got two now, there's somebody over there.
Do you think they might have
a, oh, no, it's not the green female. No, these guys don't like each other. They've missed.
Thought we were going to see a fight then.
We thought we were going to see a little bit of trouble. But what I think happens is that the orange flash, the male orange tits, will compete against each other. I'm flashier than you. I'm brighter than you. I'm stronger. Okay. I'm more vibrant. Same thing with purple emperors. It could be happening with these orange tits. That needs looking at as well.
So we've talked about the beautiful flash of the orange on the male's upper wings, and the fact that the females are quite plain, but they've got an amazing underwing, haven't they, Matthew?
Yep, absolutely. With most of our British butterflies, the males are the more attractive of the sexes. But the undersides of the orange tip are pretty similar, in that the hind wing has got this wonderful dapple of white and darkish green. And both males and females roost on the flowers of their food plants, lady smock, jack in the hedge, or garlic mustard, on other white flowers. And they tuck their forewings behind their hind wings, and they are so well camouflaged.
They just disappear, don't they?
They disappear with that dappled green and white. It's a wonderful piece of nature's camouflage.
And actually, if you look very closely under a microscope, it's not green at all. It's actually yellow and black. The scales are yellow and black, but for our eyes,
which make
it makes a kind of mossy green kind of colour.
Yeah.
And it's, like you say, it's actually a very pretty coloured green, and it just blends in so well with the surroundings, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And very safe place to roost if you've got those wings disguising you.
They're very clever, these creatures.
They are.
Well, anyway, what we've got here is along this lag, shallow, partly wooded stream coombe, male orange tips just patrolling quite long lengths.
Long, thin territories.
Yeah. They're going a long way, and they go up to one end of effectively it's the ride, really, and then they turn around and come back again, and occasionally they meet up and squabble. And so what they're looking for is virgin females, freshly emerged females, and they mate. The plain females are mated very soon after, after emergence, really on their maiden flight. And I know this from my garden and porch breeding, because the females, either they fly out and land on a bush in front, they are picked up by one of these boys, PDQ. they mate for about 45 minutes, by the way.
Gosh, that's quite a long time.
Yeah, and
actually,
an alpha male, I had last year during lockdown, I had an alpha male who I called Neil, and I can't possibly say why I called him Neil, who actually mated with three different females, all freshly emerged from the porch, in one day.
Wow, he's a busy boy.
I'm outdone.
And when the females are laying their eggs, they... what I've read is that they can tell if an egg has already been laid on a particular plant, because really one plant can only host one caterpillar, because otherwise there won't be enough food for more than one, although sometimes you will see more than one. So the female can pick up the pheromones, is that right?
Yes, a scent. Yeah.
A scent. That basically means that there's already an egg being laid on there.
Yeah.
Which is quite amazing. She's pick it up through her feet.
Yes, right.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So they do that, and also they don't want huge patches of lady smock or garlic mustard. They actually lay on the isolated plants.
Mm.
I think because that means there's going to be fewer eggs laid on them, less competition.
Oh, I see.
more for me to eat. But yes, they it's unusual to find more than one or two eggs on any one flower head. And of course they've got several little florets in each in each flower head. In years ago when we were boys and we used to, well, you weren't, but I was, and we used to breed, well, there's two orange tips now, look, and we used to breed these things. Obviously weren't very good at them, because actually sometimes the caterpillars used to eat each other. I haven't had that happen for a number of years, and it's either because I got better at breeding these things or because they've grown out of the habit, which is less likely. So I think they can be cannibalistic.
I've heard that, yeah. So that's why you would only lay one egg.
I haven't had that. I haven't observed that personally for decades.
It's fascinating. And they lay the most beautiful eggs, don't they? These lovely little kind of orange. It's almost like an elongated pumpkin, isn't it? An orange ridged kind of egg.
Well, it starts off white. And then after a couple of days, it changes colour and becomes... almost as orange as a slightly duller version of the orange tip four-wing splash. And then they hatch after 10 days, 14 days, depending on the weather. And then a little caterpillar... caterpillars actually feed up pretty quick because they've got to. And their aim is to get into that pupal stage, get out of this vulnerable... a caterpillar stage as quickly as possible. Here he comes. He's going to come and see me. Oh, over the street.
Oh, and lovely flyby.
I had a look at a wooden anemone flower because it was white. He thought he attracted to things which are white in case it might be a female orange tip. And then off he went. And another one will be down.
You've got a bee fly on your next to your shoe.
I've got a dark edged bee fly, Bombylius. Major female, and she's wanting to lay eggs, and she is, because flick, flick, flick.
And she's got terrible habits as well, hasn't she? She's flicking her eggs into
solitary bees.
Solitary bee holes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually rather a beastly world out there, and basically everyone eats or does something despicable to everyone else.
Oh gosh, and there's a wasp down there, I think.
There's a queen wasp.
Queen wasp. It's all going on around here.
Yeah, well, this is spring, it's a truly wonderful spring, but I actually don't think that our spring would be the same without the orange tip. I think it's an essential element of the British spring.
I know I'm always waiting for the orange tip. You're kind of scouting the road verges, and if you're going for a walk... You're just constantly looking out for them until you see one, and you're like, yes, it's officially spring. It's like the swallows arriving, isn't it? But they can go on quite late on into the season, can't they, orange tips? I think they've been recorded as late as maybe August or even September.
Occasionally one emerges at a silly time of year, and I think these might be ones which are pupated in greenhouses or the likes, and so they come out of an unusually hot environment. I can tell you that the latest I've seen a proper first brood orange tip was the 7th of July 1979, which was at the back end of a severe winter and a late spring. And I remember the date because it was actually my wedding day.
So
there you are. It's still in my diary as a personal record. But it's highly unlikely, given the way that the seasons are getting earlier and earlier for these things, I'll ever see a July orange tip again. Indeed, June sightings are now pretty scarce, certainly down south, in the south of England. They're usually gone by the beginning of June. And in days of yore, you used to see your first orange tip here in Sussex on about the 16th of April. You'd see your last on the 16th of June, which is about the day the cuckoo used to stop calling as well. But those June sightings have really thinned out and largely dried out. Last year they were well gone by the end of May. So it's an early spring butterfly,
It'll be interesting to see what they do this year, because we're sort of, what, we're 26th of April today, and the oak leaves really not out yet, are they? We've seen the odd tree are coming out.
I'm surprised, and yet the bluebells are well out.
Yes.
I'm surprised that the oaks aren't more in leaf, but they've been held back by frost after frost after frost. We've had frost most nights this April, which is most unusual.
And it's been incredibly dry as well, hasn't it? I mean, the ground here is cold, really dry.
Cold drought and a blackthorn winter, and the ground is not just dry, it's concrete hard, and it's starting...
It's like July proportions
already. It's starting to crack the gape and chasm. And if this drought goes on for much longer, that's exactly what it's going to do. The cracks in the wheel clay, and one of the other clays as well, which opened up last late July, were so prominent in that heat wave we had the first 10 days or so of August last year. They're all going to come back out again, but much earlier in the year. Challenging times.
It is, and really interesting, you know, as an ecologist or a naturalist, to see these changes happening and to be able to actually see it in our own notebooks.
To write it down. Constant change. Nature is a dynamism. It's not stable. Nothing has a set pattern in time. There's a constant change and adaptation to change. But this petal butterfly, we think, is doing reasonably well.
It seems to have had I've seen a lot this spring so far.
Because they've had the right weather.
And the lady smock or cuckoo flower, or milkmaid, whatever you call it, it also had a pretty good year. It's been fairly prolific in a lot of areas. And so orange tips are generally associated with quite sort of damp ground, aren't they?
Well, the food plants are primarily, certainly lady smock and Jack in the Hedge is, as the name suggests, more of a hedgerow plant. It has a bit of a problem because actually the hedge cutter comes along late summer or early winter and trims not just the hedge these days but the actual verge as well, and where it hits the ground it creates pockets of pear ground which is just right for Jack in the Hedge to seed into. So you then get a terrific seeding of Jack in the Hedge along these minor road lane verges, which sounds great, but then the hedge cutter must not come back from an orange tip point of view and a green vein white point of view, because they also breed on the same plant. That hedge cutter mustn't come back until those caterpillars have been and gone. They've fed, they've moved off the food plant and gone to pupate, hopefully deep in the hedge where they're so safe from the trimmer. You know, so early midsummer verge cutting is actually pretty disastrous for this butterfly.
You're kind of encouraging it, aren't you? And then sort
it's
of
a trap.
You've back.
You've got it. It's an absolute trap. And these female orange tips and the female green vein whites that also breed profusely on garlic mustard and lady smock, they've got to get savvy to that. Good luck.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, they might sort of over time, obviously, the genetics of the slightly earlier pupating ones might win, mightn't they? Yeah,
well, hopefully. But one of the beneficiaries of plant life's ongoing verge mowing campaign, which is campaigning for later starts to the mowing season, second half of the summer, one of the beneficiaries away from the plants of that would actually be the orange tip butterfly. So it can piggyback on the back of plant life's road verge.
Fantastic.
Mowing campaign, beautifully. Let's give it some hope.
Definitely. So is there anything that people can do at home in their gardens to help encourage orange tips into their lives?
Yeah, easily. Because it breeds on quite a variety of food plants. The biggest, the most favoured is probably garlic mustard, which is also called Jack in the Hedge. I'm afraid I've been very naughty and used both those names.
They're both good names, aren't they?
Yeah, but it is slightly confusing. Garlic mustard or Jack in the Hedge. It's quite easy to get going in a pocket of bare ground In any garden other than on very sandy, dry, sandy soils, anything with a little bit of clay in it, including in shade or high summer shade. And just gather some seed off the pods and just chuck it in the garden. I mean, it's all over my garden now. Let it do its thing. And it's a great food plant for orange tips and green vein whites. Occasionally large white breeds on it as well, and they even had a few small whites on it. And it's a very popular nectar source, as is Lady's Smock as well for spring.
And they're both pretty plants to have in your garden as
well,
aren't they?
Every right to be here, and they're not going to be invasive. Oh, we've got a holly blue, which used to be called azure blue. It's a male, the purest blue imaginable.
It's so pretty,
as
isn't it?
As blue as the sky.
And the pale undoing as well.
I love them so much. Mm. So these are all some of our most beautiful spring butterflies. And I think my message is, enjoy spring. Enjoy our spring butterflies, because spring wouldn't be spring without them.
Absolutely. And on that happy, lovely note, Matthew, that's a wrap. Thank you so much. It's been delightful spending the day with you, a lovely spring day with you. And I think we should finish our lunch and head on and see what else we can find out in the wildland.
Into the wildland.
and beyond. Thank you for tuning in, and I really hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, this podcast wouldn't have been possible without some rather brilliant people. So heartfelt thanks go to Leah Brazier for the wonderful artwork, Matt Davidson for his super music, Ian Bunn for his ace editing skills, and Sideshow Dave for his ongoing support and enthusiasm. Huge thanks go to Matthew too for sharing his wealth of knowledge and love for the natural world with us. Tune in again soon for the next instalment of the Net Wildland podcast, when we go out at dawn with Sideshow Dave to experience the birdsong of the wildland.